Second case for argument this morning is Kawasaki v. Bombardier Recreational. Mr. Sandberg.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court. May it please you, counsel. I'm John Sandberg, counsel for Bombardier Recreational Products, which I may also sometimes refer to as BRP. This court should reverse Judge Herndon's ruling denying our motion to stay because Bombardier did not implicitly waive its contractual right to arbitration. First of all, as to the facts of what happened, the factual support in question here are really not disputed. What happened, when it happened, and for the most part, why it happened is not in dispute. It's not disputed as to what happened in the Eastern District of Texas when Kawasaki moved to reopen the litigation and force compliance with the settlement. It's not disputed that BRP attacked the jurisdiction of the court to do anything, and the court agreed that it had no jurisdiction. Not disputed that BRP thought the settlement agreement was a cross-license and nothing further was needed between the parties, and Kawasaki disagreed with that. BRP, in other words, had the position that there was nothing to be done. There was no dispute. Kawasaki thought there was something to be done, and it was the one who had the claim against BRP.
I have just a kind of threshold procedural question.
Sure.
What is this case doing in Southern Illinois?
That's where the plaintiff, there are jurisdictional motions that are still pending, so that's where they thought they could get jurisdiction over all the parties. And there was no dispute as to personal jurisdiction as to Bombardier.
Nope, nobody's got any connection to Southern Illinois, right?
This dispute does not have a connection with the Southern District of Illinois.
Neither do any of the parties, right? We've got a Japanese corporation. Your client is the Delaware Corporation based
yes.
in Wisconsin.
We happen to have We have a plant in the district.
Okay, there you go. That's what I was looking for.
We do have a plant in the district. But it's not, the plant's not involved in the litigation, but we have a plant in the district.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Briefly, a timeline of events. March of 08, settlement agreement takes effect. June of 08, just 3 months later, BRP tells Kawasaki in writing that it is willing to arbitrate this dispute that's arisen. April 09, next year, Kawasaki files its action in the Eastern District of Texas. September, the Eastern District finds it has no jurisdiction to do anything. Kawasaki appeals to the Federal Circuit and then dismisses its appeal in 2010. Same month, August 2010, this suit is filed. 2 months later, we file our motion to dismiss or stay.
In Texas, there, I guess you mentioned at some point about arbitration, and the court said you're not even going to get there and dismissed. Is that correct?
Well, we didn't ask the court. We told the court about the arbitration provision in the process of bringing forward the motion that the court had no jurisdiction to rule on anything. But we didn't ask the court to rule on the jurisdiction issue. The court below and Kawasaki claim that three events constitute implicit waiver. I'll briefly address each. The facts of these events are not in dispute, but whether each event indicates conduct inconsistent with the desire to arbitrate is very much in dispute. The first issue raised below and argued here is that BRP raised the issue of arbitration 2 years earlier without pursuing it then. There's no question that when Kawasaki first threatened to sue, BRP said in writing that it was willing to arbitrate. Admittedly, BRP did not thereafter file an arbitration claim against Kawasaki. What could BRP have claimed in an arbitration claim? It was of the belief that no action was necessary. It was Kawasaki that had a claim against BRP. An arbitration dispute, just like a federal court case, is initiated by making a claim, asking for relief from the arbitration panel. Kawasaki was the only party who wanted relief. BRP could not force Kawasaki to make a claim in arbitration. And now Kawasaki faults BRP that it did not indicate its intent to arbitrate in these 2 years. But there's no way to really indicate evidence intent to arbitrate other than by making a claim in arbitration, and BRP had no claim against Kawasaki. The failure to pursue arbitration when you don't have a claim is not a waiver of your right to arbitrate when a claim is then made against you. Finally, the settlement agreement in the mediation provision refers to, quote, the party asserting such dispute. That was Kawasaki, not BRP. The 2 years that passed before this motion was all pre-suit inactivity, as the Fifth Circuit called it in the Walker case. And as the court there said, this inactivity really doesn't mean anything on the waiver question. The second of the three events that is claimed to be an implicit waiver is participating in settlement discussions and participating in a court-mandated mediation program. The parties in the settlement agreement itself, in the mediation provision, outlined a process before arbitration that was to be used by the parties. The parties in the agreement, per the agreement, were supposed to first talk about the dispute and then, if not settled, mediate the dispute. Was some of this two-year gap taken up with settlement talk? Absolutely it was. When Kawasaki then appealed the decision of the Eastern District that there was no jurisdiction, the federal court had a court-ordered mediation process just like this court does. In May 2010, the parties had a mediation meeting. And, of course, the appeal was over this jurisdiction or no jurisdiction to do anything. Since the agreement encouraged informal attempts to resolve disputes and the federal courts promote informal attempts to resolve disputes, it is anomalous to suggest that this very behavior results in implicit waiver. Settlement talk is never inconsistent with a desire to arbitrate. The third reason given for implicit waiver is that BRP did not move to dismiss or stay the Eastern District of Texas suit based on the settlement agreement. Instead, it moved to dismiss based on jurisdiction. Let's analyze that. Unless BRP wanted to voluntarily submit to the court's jurisdiction in Texas, it had to raise the jurisdiction argument at its first opportunity. So what Kawasaki is really saying is that BRP should have both moved to stay or dismiss, along with the argument on the jurisdiction at the same time.
In fact, you made an arbitration argument or alluded to the arbitration clause in the settlement agreement in connection with your pleadings in response to the 60B motion.
Yes. We brought it up.
The arbitration argument was preserved in that response that you filed.
Yes, Judge.
In addition to the jurisdictional argument.
Even though we didn't formally move on that ground, we told the court about it.
Well, right, and you wouldn't expect that in Rule 60B litigation anyway. You wouldn't expect a motion in response to a motion. You'd expect a response raising the grounds for your response, which you filed, saying there's no jurisdiction to litigate the 60B motion because any dispute about the settlement agreement is a contract dispute and belongs in state court. And in addition, we've got an arbitration clause.
Correct.
So
that is what we argued.
Okay.
Yeah, and even if we had filed both motions at the same time, the court would have determined I have no jurisdiction to do anything under 60B, and then said I can't rule on this second motion because I have no jurisdiction to do anything. None of the actions by BRP in the period from 2008 to 2010 are inconsistent with an intent to arbitrate. The facts are consistent with a party who wants to settle a dispute and stay out of court. And this is not a case like the Cabinetry versus Craftmade case decided by this court, where Craftmade had delayed seeking arbitration and had no explanation for the delay. BRP has explained what happened and why it happened in the time period in question. And, of course, I would note that Cabinetry talks about the effect of prejudice to the party resisting arbitration. The only prejudice issue we bring up here is that it is appropriate for you to consider how, if at all, Kawasaki was harmed by these events that happened before our motion to dismiss was filed last year. Kawasaki hasn't claimed that this delay has harmed it in any way. Prejudice to Kawasaki, if they had been harmed, might indicate that our conduct was inconsistent with an intent to arbitrate. But again, there is no such claim here. In conclusion, BRP at no time prior to its filing its motion to dismiss or to stay acted inconsistent with its contractual right to arbitrate, and this court should reverse.
If I could just clarify your argument about the non-signatory parties, the bank and the two attorneys.
Yes, Judge.
You don't represent them. They're separately represented.
They are separately rented, and the only thing as to those non-parties to the arbitration agreement, we don't think their presence should affect how you consider waiver.
Okay.
And if the court reversed and we're going to arbitration, we think that there shouldn't be any obstacle from them, if they wanted to participate in it. But that would be an issue for the district court to resolve.
Well, and also an issue for those parties to raise.
Well, yes.
You don't have authority to raise that on, or standing
correct,
to raise that on their behalf. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Sandberg. Ms. Mueller?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. My name is Rick Miller. I represent Kawasaki in these proceedings. And if it pleases the court, this case is pending here today because when we filed the lawsuit in the Southern District of Illinois, BRP filed a motion to stay the proceedings and to compel arbitration. And the issue, I think, for the court today is, having waited for over 2 years to make such a motion, does that conduct, considering the history of the litigation, both in the Eastern District of Texas and before the Federal Circuit, evidence and actions inconsistent with their interest in arbitration?
There wasn't anything in the procedural history prior to that that required them to make that motion. And in particular, the case law is entirely on your opponent's side on that point.
I think that if you read the Cabinetry case, it seems like what the point that the court was making there is that they should have been asserting their rights at their very first opportunity.
The facts of that case are extremely different, or at least the procedural facts of that case are extremely different. The problem there was that there had been a good deal of substantive litigation, not jurisdictional litigation, but substantive litigation that had occurred. And here, all we've got is jurisdictional litigation on your motion to reopen the Texas case under 60B. They respond with a jurisdictional argument. They also specifically preserved the arbitration argument by raising it in their response to your 60B motion, which was filed the very same month.
Well,
the Texas court decided the matter on jurisdictional grounds. It went to the Federal Circuit. It was dismissed. Then there were settlement negotiations in the ensuing months, which is not litigation, so they weren't obligated to do anything then, and the case law is on their side in that regard, too. And then when you filed this suit, they promptly responded with the stay motion, which was the earliest opportunity they were required to. What's wrong with that?
I'm not agreeing with any of that.
What's wrong with that conclusion?
But let me, if I might, I mean, in the Katerji case, there was 7 months of activity in which there was document production and some several thousand documents. But the court there said clearly, Kraftmaid, if it wanted to, arbitration, could have moved for a stay in the suit in the Wisconsin State Court. It did not. Instead, it moved the case to the Federal District Court. By doing so without at the same time asking the district court for an order to arbitrate, it manifested an intention to resolve the dispute through the process of the federal court.
Jurisdictional dismissal does not manifest an intent to resolve the dispute in federal court.
I'm not agreeing that that was.
What about the Halim case? What about the Sharif case?
I'm not
and
agreeing with you that that was.
Other cases in that line of case law that is directly opposed to your position and directly opposed to what the district court ruled in this case.
I'm not agreeing that that was the issue, the only issue that was in the district. The two issues that were made in the motion in the Eastern District Court were, number one, that because of the fraud that was engaged in by BRP, that the court should set it aside, and that, number two, having set it aside, that he should enforce the settlement agreement. And BRP responded to both of those. Now, one argument is that whatever fraud there may have been in the Eastern District of Texas, since it wasn't fraud during the discovery process, it wasn't the kind of fraud that would enable the court to reopen the case, but that, number two, the court shouldn't enforce the settlement agreement. And it seems like they and BRP was perfectly happy to submit those arguments to and have the court rule. They could have easily at that point in time said, and furthermore, Your Honor, you know, we want to make a motion. They clearly know how to make a motion to stay and move for compel arbitration, which they did not do.
The arbitration argument is in their response to your 60B motion. The first argument is, there's no jurisdiction under Kokkonen. It's a settlement agreement. That's a contract. It belongs in state court. To the extent we're going to litigate this, the second argument is, besides, we've got an arbitration provision.
And this court has had other cases in which parties, at the end of their brief, have made mention of the fact that there's arbitration clauses without pursuing their rights.
This is in their response in a substantive way. It's not something that was
And this court has had other cases in which parties have stuck at the end of their brief.
That's not what this is, counsel. That's a mischaracterization of their response.
They did not. The parties here did not. The reason why this case is here right now is because BRP made a motion to stay and to compel arbitration. They have waited for over 2 years to make that motion.
They've preserved the argument every step of the way. They won the jurisdictional battle in the Texas court, and you abandoned that route. They did everything that they needed to do to preserve the argument.
They even followed you to the court in D.C., and then you dismissed that.
I'm sorry, say again, Your Honor?
The Federal Circuit. They followed you to the Federal Circuit.
And we participated in the mediation process there for many months.
Which would have to do anyway in arbitration. But nevertheless, it all seems to me they're just following where you go. And finally, you get here, this other district, where you actually have a claim, and then they assert arbitration. I'm not sure when you think maybe in Texas, what you're trying to say, that you should have done it then.
I think they could have done it at any time. And certainly
What were they going to do in the Federal Circuit?
They could have filed it in the Federal Circuit, but they certainly could have filed in the Eastern District of Texas. If their position really was
and that's again what the court dismissed that. They didn't have jurisdiction. And so then what are you supposed to do? Well, what's arbitrary? He says, I don't have jurisdiction.
If BRP wants to assert their rights to arbitration, they could have filed an arbitration at any time.
What was the claim against them?
There's no dispute here but that they promised a subordination agreement from the bank, which they have refused and failed to deliver. And it seems like if they really believed that this was a dispute that should be in arbitration, it seems like they could go to arbitration and ask for declaratory relief, that they don't need to, as they now say, that it's unnecessary.
They don't have to. It's your claim. the burden's on you to move to compel arbitration. The burden would be on them to move to stay a claim pending arbitration, but that doesn't require them to give up jurisdictional arguments. The only claim in Texas was your 60B motion to reopen the Texas patent claim or patent action to litigate settlement agreement that belonged in state court if it was going to be litigated at all under Kekkonen. And they were entitled to rely on that argument as their primary defense to your 60B motion. And then they also did what they had to do to preserve the arbitration argument. And it was not just inserted at the end of the brief. It was in a substantive way.
Their brief, I don't believe, is actually a part of the record in this case.
It doesn't have to be. It's a legal pleading. We take judicial notice of those matters.
Then it should be crystal clear that what they did not do is file the motion that they filed here, that they could have filed at any...
They don't have to in response to a 60B motion that has no jurisdiction.
I think that if you look at this case and you say they have now been through three, this is the now third... court system in which they've been asserting
they were winning at every step of the way.
Exactly right. And as long as they were winning, they were happy to submit the dispute to the federal courts. And as soon as they feel so they might not win, they now want to have arbitration, which is exactly the conduct.
Counsel, you're failing to grapple with the reality here that they won on jurisdictional grounds. So their substantive argument about arbitration, which was specifically preserved, is now primary, because there isn't a jurisdictional, or there may be a jurisdictional issue in addition, but when you filed your 60B motion, they were entitled to lead with their jurisdictional argument and also preserve the arbitration argument to the extent that they lost that. That's what they did. They didn't have to force the case into arbitration and forego their jurisdictional argument, and that's what you seem to be arguing.
What I'm arguing is that they certainly could have done it. They have waited for over 2 years to assert their rights to.
They didn't have to.
Well, so you, I guess that will be some decision. It is clear that if you submit your dispute to the federal courts as opposed to.
They didn't. They responded to your motion. That's not submitting their dispute to the federal courts. They responded to your motion with a jurisdictional argument that the case doesn't belong here.
And that the court should not enforce the settlement, which was on the merits. We had two arguments in front of the Texas court, that the case ought to be reopened and that the settlement agreement should be enforced. They responded to both arguments, and their argument was that the settlement agreement should not be enforced. And that was an argument that they made on the merits.
Mr. Miller, if it were arbitration to be enforced, what was the specific venue for that to take place?
Dallas, Texas.
Dallas, Texas?
Yes. It's in the arbitration clause, as was the specification for mediation. Both of them, I think, indicated that those would be done in Dallas, Texas.
So your position is the Texarkana court could enforce arbitration?
Certainly it could.
That's the correct venue?
As far as BRP, obviously not the other parties. It's more challenging. I mean, obviously, somewhere between the Bank of Montreal and the lawyers, somebody is responsible for the fact that these cases were dismissed, and they falsely represented that the subordination agreement would be forthcoming, and it was not.
Is Texarkana in the same district as Dallas?
Well, no, that one I don't.
I don't know even under – I share my colleague's view of this jurisdictional issue, but even if they move to compel arbitration, assuming they do that, my question to you is whether that district court in Texarkana could have compelled arbitration.
Well, I don't know. I've had cases in the Eighth Circuit where there have been arbitration clauses that required arbitration in Los Angeles, and the district courts there have told the parties to go arbitrate in Los Angeles.
I think the statute requires that if a specific venue has been named for arbitration, it's only a district court in that venue that can enforce the arbitration clause.
I've never had that issue come up.
94 federal districts can enforce the arbitration clause. So that was my inquiry.
If the court, presumably I would think that if the district court had jurisdiction over the parties, then it could order them to
I'm not sure of that.
Well, and I don't know the answer to that. I've never had that. As I say, I have had situations where they've...
If you specifically mention in the arbitration clause a specific venue, I think the Act requires, Section 4 requires the parties to, that only a court within the district can enter an order compelling arbitration. I think that's... Well, that's right. You can continue.
Well, in any event, I mean, it does seem to me that if you look at the cabinetry case, which seems to require that the parties are expected to assert their rights at the earliest opportunity.
Did you resist the arbitration argument in the Texas court?
Say again?
Did you resist the arbitration argument in the Texas court?
I don't recall us saying anything about the arbitration.
So you conceded it?
I just don't remember what position we took about the arbitration in the Texas court.
I find that very hard to believe.
That I don't recall what we said? Well, I can't speak to that. I just don't remember what position we took. I can't imagine that we... were agreeing to arbitration, that this was the kind of, and I don't think it's been our position all along that the arbitration provision was really intended to cover a dispute of this kind in any event. But nonetheless, I think that if you look at the language of the decision in the cabinetry case, I think that it would be hard for this court to come to the conclusion that BRP has been asserting their right to arbitrate at the earliest opportunity, and that they did have opportunity prior to this time to assert their rights, which they did not do, and whether you look upon this as being a waiver or a forfeiture, that's to say an untimely assertion of their rights, I think under either one of those doctrines, the district court's conclusion should be upheld.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Sandberg?
Judge Flom, you raised one question about, I think, Section 4 of the statute. I think the only district court that can enforce an arbitration award is the...
Any district court can stay it.
Right. Yes, and I think that's the distinction. Any can stay. The only one that can enforce is where the district that encompasses the place where the arbitration took place.
Well, that's my understanding. All right. Thank you, Sandberg. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.